Martin Belange from Department of Cooperative Governance Traditional Affairs in KwaZulu-Natal, and I'm assisted here today with Gert Roos, who's from our legal section, also from the same department. Chair, basically what we're wanting to do, we're wanting to restrict our, because of the time frames that we've got, the 20 minutes that we've got, we're only going to look at two issues at this stage. One will be the Municipal Training Planning Tribunal, and the other one would be the internal appeals. The rest of the documentation is contained, or the rest of the comments that we've made is contained in the about a 40-page document that we've already submitted to the department. And we'll basically split the presentation today. I'm more on the practical side, so I've been involved in the practical implementation of developments and land development applications for the last 16 years, whilst Mr. Roos has been involved in the legal side, so he'll be dealing with all the legal related matters. Thanks, Chair.
Chief, please. What you presented to the department is not the same thing, because separation of powers requires that you present to Parliament. That's why we want that 40-page document. Parliament, yes?
We have submitted it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And just maybe another correction is that I see my name also appears tomorrow in Salva. That's also incorrect. It's today and it's focusing on it all. Alright, so I'm just going to then quickly look at the constitutional position. I'm going to go through it quite quickly because I think most of us in this room are familiar with it. And we've heard that big court case, everybody can know about it, Johannesburg versus Gauteng Development Tribunal. And what the court said is that an Act of Parliament cannot assign municipal planning to a tribunal consisting of officials and private persons. I did sort of summarize it a bit there. The court didn't say quite exactly like that, but it used some of that wording in its judgment. Then what does Splunk actually do? It does assign that function to municipal planning to a tribunal consisting of officials and private persons. So we are concerned about that from purely from a constitutional point of view, in addition to the practical considerations which Martins will do. Really, if one think about it, the tribunals envisaged in SPLUM doesn't look all that much different from the ones we had under the DFA. The only real difference is that the ones appointed by the Premier, whereas the other one, municipalities got appointed, and that there are no provincial officials on municipal planning tribunal. That really is the only difference. Should we look at who appoints it, or should we rather focus on who should perform the function? We believe that the determining factor is not who appoints Premier or municipality, but who has the right to perform the function. And the Constitution does give that function to municipalities. That's section 1561A of the Constitution. Municipality has the executive authority in respect of and has the right to administer municipal planning. That's their constitutional right. Whether we agree with it or disagree with it, we think that it should all be done by more technical people or by a different sphere of government, that's neither here nor there. We've got to respect the Constitution and what it says. National government can regulate that, no problem with that, but it cannot impede on that power. And so what we're saying is that where the municipality wants to give that power to the tribunal, absolutely no problem. That is their prerogative, it's theirs to keep, it's theirs to give. But we cannot say in a national bill or act that they must give it to a committee like that. We can say that they need to consult certain people, that they may need to establish committees to guide them. We can do all sorts of things. We can regulate that power, but we cannot force them to give it away. And so what we are asking for is that becomes a voluntary thing. We're not saying don't provide for tribunals. By all means, do. But it should be something that's optional, completely their free choice. I think possibly where the big difference is isn't so much a constitutional position, because I did see the slideshow that was done at the MinMEC last week. But what it did say was that what they actually have to give to the officials is day-to-day administration. And we're not convinced about that. Just some data from time, we could have brought some applications with us here today. We don't believe those things are day-to-day administration things. New industrial areas, new commercial areas, I've got examples here from a place called Hilton in KwaZulu-Natal, where there's a scheme amendment to completely move the town centre, to develop a new town centre because it's now outgrown its existing town centre, but it's too small, and there's no land around there, so they have to find new land. That's not a day-to-day thing, but that's much bigger than that. And we believe that councillors have a prerogative to be involved in that. It's their constitutional right to do that, but we cannot actually take that away. So I think that's, on the legal side, the point that we wanted to make there.
Thanks. Chair, basically from my side, with our look at all the practical considerations, we've had a number of tribunals or similar structures that we've been managing in KwaZulu-Natal back basically for the last, since 1952, for the last 70 years. And I thought it's important today to come and share with yourself some critical information regarding the day-to-day running of these setups and these tribunals. And I thought that would be important to come and share with you. The other thing that's quite important that we've picked up over the years is that, generally speaking, these bodies never run on their own. They always act on the advice of a professional within the organisation, often putting a further burden on the organisation itself. The first two, the Town Planning Commission and the Private Townships Board, were involved basically with the dealing with the commission was involved with your scheme amendments and your N&D applications, where the Private Townships Board was involved with the townships as well as or the development of towns together with policies. But they've been involved since 1952. I want to really focus my energies today on the DFA tribunal, which was initiated in 1998, because I've got much more practical experience about it, and I can share that quite easily with yourselves. The other thing that's quite important is that these bodies never run on their own. They need support staff. At the moment in KZN until the 17th of June, when it was kind of discontinued, the DFA was discontinued, we're running that show about one registrar, three deputy registrars, and three admin personnel to assist them. That was on a full-time basis, and then obviously there were designated offices per municipality. So you basically had seven staff that you needed to provide for, and we were, at best, the highest number that we had in terms of the tribunal was about 45 people. So you needed to serve seven people to run 45 tribunal members. The other thing that's important to note is that you always need to have a quorum. In terms of the DFA, we used to have two members of non-government and two government members together with the chair. So you basically get five members, and I can assure you it's no easy task to get five people to sit down on the same day to hear the same application. It takes a lot of time and energy. Adjourned hearings, there's often hearings that continued for more than one day, requiring for the same members to be called to have a quorum. Again, not a simple task at all. Let's look at some reality. In 2009, we had about 1,000 applications that came to KwaZulu-Natal through other legislation, the Town Planning Ordinance, KwaZulu Land Affairs Act, etc., that we were busy with at that stage, of which 45 were Development Facilitation Act applications which had to go through the tribunal. And that year, we looked at plus minus 60 hearings and inspections and continued hearings, plus minus, if you take a 52-week year, once a week at least. The cost of that, you're looking at about 20,000 rand. That was for the preparation time for the tribunal members, their cost of reimbursing that together with their S&T claims, that type of thing. Comes to about 20,000 a hearing, 1.2 million rand to run those 60 hearings, give or take a bit. Then if you look at that, that was only those 45 applications with only 5% of the applications that were being dealt with by our province. If one had to multiply it with all applications, you're looking at 24 million rand a year in terms of cost. And we're just saying, let's look at some of those practical issues. In terms of the implementation and buying, I think this is quite a critical lesson that we've learned in KZN over the last few years as well. And there's a couple of examples I want to quickly share with you. The first one is the actual PDA, KwaZulu-Natal Planning and Development Act, which we implemented 2 years ago. In May 2010, it came into operation. We've only now, recently, were able to put together the appeals tribunal. It goes through a whole process of advertisement, calling for members, re-advertising your names once you've got that in order to get public comment, etc., etc. It takes a long time, and in between there's some legal obstacles that could come your way, as we found. If you look at the Property Rights Act, it was initiated in 2005. By 2009, 30 municipalities had still not fully implemented things, losing or potentially losing 410 million rand in revenue. And there was a money incentive for municipalities. This act doesn't bring really a money incentive. Yes, there is development, and I think hopefully everybody wants that development to take place. But just another critical issue to look at is the buy-in of municipalities to do this function. Then if we need to look at the expertise for tribunals, if we've got 261 municipalities through the South Africa, I think that's the latest number, and you need at least 20 members per municipality, you're looking at 5,200 members nationally. And I'm just asking again, do we have that type of expertise nationally in this country? Then if we look particularly at Gauteng, they had 14,000 applications annually, around about 14,000, of which 60 was DFA. But can you take 14,000 applications through a tribunal? I looked at that math last night, and if you take your average year, you're looking at 56 applications daily, to be dealt with daily, and that excludes the possibility of dealing with site inspections as well. So a very important consideration, again, I believe that we need to look at. Then in terms of the last slide on the practical considerations, we believe the tribunals can work where there are your highly capacitated municipalities, where you've got the necessary staff in place. We can formalise the existing situation. We also believe it will work where you've got low levels of development and there's experience in the municipality. We believe that could work there as well. Where it won't work, and in KZN we've got that, where you've got low capacity and high levels of development, where those two would just not match, and you're going to have problems there. We believe the solution is, one of the solutions will be your joint tribunals, or the stumped solution is joint tribunals, but that will also only work where there is spare capacity, where there's insufficient capacity, that won't work. And as we already said earlier on, we believe that training tribunals must be a voluntary option here. It mustn't be something that is the only option. Thank you.
Back to the legal side again. Back to the legal side. The right of appeal, I know that is something that's not cast in stone. I think that is something where they are still looking in the bill at other options. I don't think anybody's made up their mind and say it will be internal appeals. But let's just look at the internal appeal option and just look at if it is viable. The first thing is that we're concerned with the right of appeal that's been granted in the bill. It's very, very narrow, much more narrow than what we're used to. It says that you can only appeal if you can prove a right that has been adversely affected. We don't know why it's made that narrow. We've had appeals in our legislation since 1952 in KwaZulu-Natal. We never had a problem with too many appeals. I know that big developments do attract those. It's an uncomfortable thing. But normally society is better off for it. Normally even if appeal doesn't succeed, the traffic requirements are improved, the roads are improved. There's normally good things coming from there. And so you've just got to take the bit of bad with a bit of good in that situation. In reality, according to the bill, very few people actually be able to prove such a right that's been adversely affected. The applicant appellant would be able to, because obviously their application was turned down. But your public that objects to a development or aspect of it or want an improvement to the roads, they won't have a leg to stand on. That will make it very easy for municipality or tribunal, whichever form it takes, to just ignore planning considerations, because there will be no fear that decision can be challenged unless you take it to High Court, which will starting price there, I think it's about 40,000 rand. It's not going to go there for anything cheaper than that, I imagine. And we believe that that's completely unnecessary, that one should be able to object to an application on good planning grounds, and one should be able to appeal on good planning grounds. That's been opposition for the last 51 years in KwaZulu-Natal. We do require that the person must have objected to the application first in order to have a right of appeal. We cannot allow a person not to even make a comment and then come out of the woodwork and expect everybody to now change their plans. But once we have done that, and we have done it in the time allotted forward in our process, then we do have a right of appeal. In reality, if you look at the number of applications, let's take a Gauteng example at 14,000 applications, I don't think too many of us actually went on appeal. Our new act before, we're going to have lots of appeals because we've got so many more things that you can appeal against now. You didn't have rights to appeal against in the past. And right now, I think we've got 34. We've now got 34, which we've accumulated in the last 2 years. So it's 15 appeals a year across development of a whole province like KwaZulu-Natal, which we do have a lot of development in. At the Queen's numbers are not far from that 14,000. I think that's probably about 10,000, 11,000 thereabouts. To for those could not have a right of appeal that much, completely unnecessary. Next slide, please, Martin. Then just the right of appeal, obviously it suggests that there must have been a decision. You cannot appeal if there is no decision yet, if the body is still considering the application. So by necessary implication, the mere fact that there is a right of appeal means that municipality has already made a decision. And this is an important point, because if a municipality has already made a decision, or a decision has been made in their name by a tribunal, whichever form it takes, then surely they shouldn't now consider appeal against that very same decision, because they've already got the decision made. And that is also something that's picked up in the Constitution, and rightly so. If you look at Section 33A, what does it say about appeals? What form should it take? It says national legislation must provide for the review of administrative action by a court, or where appropriate, an independent and impartial tribunal, very importantly. So I think that is something that's been, it's actually in our Bill of Rights. Let's respect that, let's honour that, and let's build on that. Next slide, please. Alright, SPLAM doesn't do that. That actually takes it, the appeal is actually to the executive mayor or the executive committee. It's an internal appeal. Is this fair? Can it be independent? Can it be impartial? Probably on non-planning matters, I think it can. But here we talk planning, and planning is something that's big, it's something that involves the whole municipality from the beginning. You don't just go and do a big development in municipality without talking to anybody and first asking them what they need, what their needs are. It's something to do, it's a whole negotiated process. So more than likely, the applicant would have consulted a ward councillor, would have made contact with the council, said, look, I'm thinking of buying some land here, thinking of a big shopping centre, what's your needs, what's your world like, what can we do for you, what's the services like, what do we need to pick up. Objectors would have consulted the ward councillor as well, equally, it's not only the applicant, they would have said, but we're worried about this new development, we're not sure if it fits within our efforts and with what we actually really wanted. Officials, these developments need services. They need to come from somewhere. A lot of that comes from municipality. They would have actually talked to their councillors and say, there's a big shopping centre coming into our area. It's going to need an upgrade of our sanitation and our water. Is it something that we should support? Do we have funding to allocate to that upgrade or that infrastructure so that they can run the shopping complex? So it's not impartial. It's not the first time it's going to see the development. And then the last point there is that council, I'm not sure there are some people that are technically qualified, but I would imagine that not too many of them are engineers and town planners, people that work with things every day. They need to draw on advice somewhere. So if the appeal is in front of them, they need to get that technical input. And where are we going to get it from? Are we just going to go back to the same officials that sat on a tribunal or that approved the development in the first place? We really have a big question mark around this.
You overstep. I know that we're not pressed with time, but it would be unfair if I give you so much time extra.
It's clear we've really good
tidy up now.
Thanks very much, Chair. Back to me, just to, for the practical considerations, Chair. Basically, just want to say, as we said earlier, we've got 51 years again of experience of these things, particularly with the Town Planning Commission and the Appeals Board, and now recently the Development Appeals Board, and these things have worked fairly well. We've used the opportunities that were given to us, and we've used the methods that, and it's worked well to us. What we're also asking is whether the Executive Mayor or Exco is best geared to deal with exchange of documents once you've got your appeal documents come in. There's exchange of documents. Are they going to be able to deal with it? There's, again, practical support for that. Are they going to deal with the site inspections, dealing with leading of evidence, getting expert advice, again, as we spoke about earlier, dealing with cross-examination, points of law, the necessary background in order to deal with those type of issues, multi-day hearings, are they able to deal with it, and then the volume of appeals. We're just asking those questions. And then last
slide, I'm not going to go through that slide at all. All I'm showing is that in all the provincial laws so far, there are tribunals of some sort being set up for appeal tribunal. None of them have gone for an internal appeal. And maybe that's just the way that we should continue to be going also in the national bill. Thanks, Chief. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. If you have any further concerns, please you can write them down and give them to the secretary of the committee so that they can be considered. We have another presentation. I'm told that the Royal Bafokeng Nation has arrived. Your presentation, sir. There is a facility here if you have an overhead projector needs.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson and members. My name is Matthew van der Wand. First thing, just to state the obvious, I'm not a Mofokeng myself. But I am an attorney who works for Bell Dewar. I'm a director there, and we act on behalf of the Royal Mofokeng Nation. Also in the building is Advocate Modiswatsile Mokate, who's the head of land affairs of the Royal Mofokeng Nation, and Teresa Talyard, who works for Royal Mofokeng Holdings, the investment vehicle of the nation. I'll just tell you a little bit of the structure of what we want to tell the portfolio committee. We're very grateful for the opportunity. I'll just talk a little bit about who the RBN is and why they have an interest in the bill.
Just 1 moment.
Yes, sir.
Be warned that you only have 20 minutes.
Yes, I will be quick. I will be short and to the point. Give an example of the kind of issues with which the Royal Mofokeng Nation is having to contend, where the zoning of its land has been disregarded. I'll talk a little bit about the RBN's infrastructure and community development initiatives relative to spatial planning law. And then I'll turn to dealing with for me and us is the most important issue, and that is whether mining and related activities should be exempt from zoning requirements. This, we say, is relevant because the RBN understands that the Chamber of Mines is going to make submissions to this committee that those activities should in fact be exempted by this bill, and the RBN has important submissions to make in this regard as to why they shouldn't be. Briefly then, the Royal Mofokeng Nation is a traditional community. It has full legal personality. It can own property and it can transact in its own name. It is corporatized, so it has various subsidiaries which deal with its business, and it holds various direct and indirect interests in mining operations in the vicinity of the land which it owns, which is in the Rustenburg area near Mofokeng, where it owns approximately 1,200 square kilometers of land in the northwest. Just briefly, the nature of the RBN's ownership, there are essentially three kinds of ownership. The one is where the land is registered in the RBN's name. The other is where, for historical reasons, basically arising from our dark past where black people couldn't own land, is held in trust by government, in the person of the Minister of Rural Development and Land Reform. So that is still owned by the Mofokeng, and in fact their court proceedings to which are not opposed by government to move that land into the name of the Mofokeng. And then there's a third category where the RBN administers the relevant land on behalf of a government by virtue of a government notice issued sometime in the 1960s. Now the RBN is interested in the bill Well, let me say this. The RBN welcomes the bill just because of how fragmented spatial planning law has become in our country. But really, the RBN's primary interest is that it's important, for reasons that will be made clear, that its land is used sustainably and for the RBN to have a strong degree of control over how its land is used in consultation with the relevant local municipality. The RBN wants to ensure that its land is used properly and in a way which benefits the members of its community. I just want to start with a rather shocking example. This is an example of what the RBN has had to contend with. It's not an isolated example, where a lawless situation causes virtually irremediable damage to community land. These pictures are of the farm Kookfontein, where prospecting rights were issued to a company which then proceeded to mine in contravention of its prospecting rights. It wasn't allowed to mine, but it did. And as you can see, it's virtually destroyed the land. I'm told that people died there as a result of the deep trenches and water left unattended. This is the kind of thing that the RBN does not want happening on its land, and it's unfortunately not the only example of people flagrantly flouting the law, including zoning law. This piece of property is zoned for agriculture. I'm not sure what kind of agriculture that is, but it's not what the RBN wants. So the RBN is looking for this bill to provide a framework where this kind of thing can't happen, and contraventions of the relevant zoning provisions are dealt with swiftly and appropriately. The RBN has a Vision 2035 and a master plan. It is essentially the RBN's infrastructure development program. It contains details of how the RBN sees its land being used and developed over the next 20 years. It is a detailed plan, pragmatic and flexible, and firmly believed in by the Khosi and the community he leads. Provision is made in it for appropriate allocation of selected properties as mining and quarrying properties. Just important for me to stress that last point on the presentation. The RBN doesn't want to sterilize its land and stop mining on its properties. That's not what the RBN is saying. The RBN wants to ensure that the activities that are conducted on RBN land are undertaken properly, sustainably, and in a lawful and sustainable manner, which would include compliance with the relevant zoning legislation. That is just a little picture of the big picture of the Rustenburg local municipality area, the Bafokeng land picture there, which shows the various activities which the RBN have envisaged for its for their land. The plan is compiled, and there's a constant dialogue between the relevant local municipality. The master plan ties in closely with the existing Rustenburg land use management scheme, which was promulgated under the old township town planning and townships ordinance of Transvaal, which was adopted in the northwest. It's a relatively and comparatively to other jurisdictions sophisticated scheme, we think, formulated in 2005, revised again in 2008, and it's in force in Rustenburg currently. The local municipality and RBN, as well as the mines in the Rustenburg area, have for the past several years been cooperating together to align the vision underlying the master plan with that of the Rustenburg local land use management scheme. The existing local municipality spatial planning framework for the RBN in Rustenburg, it's there, it's in force and properly implemented, it can work. There are areas in the Rustenburg local municipality area of jurisdiction are clearly demarcated as to what activities may be undertaken where. It is important to the RBN in that context that the bill as national legislation does not upset or undermine the existing zoning framework in place in Rustenburg. Indeed, we would say that if the bill did so, which we don't say it does in its current form, then the bill may well not pass constitutional muster for reasons which the previous speaker has actually highlighted. This is because the Constitution specifically envisages municipalities having the power and indeed the obligation to administer their land use management plans, and the Constitution also disallows national and provincial government from doing anything which undermines or hinders those obligations. The courts have interpreted municipal planning, which is what municipalities have to do in this context, to mean control and regulation of the use of land in the relevant jurisdiction. What is crucial to the RBN is that this bill does not limit Rustenburg's or any other municipality's ability to do just that. The bill as currently drafted is fine in this regard, but it's apparent that the Chamber of Mines may well make submissions to the committee which will result in a municipality not being able to exercise its constitutional obligations properly. Now, I'm sure, Honourable Chair, and members are aware of the recent Constitutional Court decision. There was a big fracas about it. It went all the way up to the Constitutional Court. But that case has clearly settled the law on whether mining companies, in addition to rights obtained under the MPRDA, need to procure the correct zoning of the land before they may commence prospecting or mining activities. The case was hotly contested by the DMR, as well as mining companies in the form of the Chamber, and the issue was extensively argued in the Constitutional Court. What the Court held in the end was simple and, we say, correct. Mining companies must comply with all law applicable to them, and this includes provincial and municipal zoning law. The decision, we say, as I've said, is correct, but the RBN understands that the Chamber is going to seek to have Parliament effectively overrule the Constitutional Court's decision by asking Parliament to insert a blanket exemption from all zoning laws throughout South Africa to mining companies doing mining or prospecting activities. With respect, this simply cannot work. Apart from the fact that such a provision, which would remove municipalities' abilities to administer and control the zoning of their land, may well be unconstitutional for reasons already mentioned, The Chamber's contention seeks to ride roughshod over the rights of a landowner. The Constitutional Court, in its judgment in the Benguinyama judgment, has already pointed out the intrusion of the rights of landowners, which the grant of a mining right causes the landowner. And we would submit that it is important that the landowner, in consultation with the relevant municipality, has sufficient control over how its land is used. Just as an aside, Honourable Chairperson, I and my firm happen to act for a number of mining companies, and they may be sitting and thinking, why is our lawyer not taking our side on this point? Well, in honesty, my advice to them is simple. You have to comply with the law applicable to you, including zoning law. There is, I will tell them, no legal basis to distinguish mining activities from any other activity. The McSan judgment is legally sound, and it is correct. In respect of mining on community land, I would tell my mining company clients, speak to the community, form proper partnerships with them, make them want you to mine on their land, get them on your side, empowered, so that the community landowner will cooperate with pleasure in procuring the necessary rezoning. It seems to me that mines who want to bypass the zoning requirements are missing an important boat. In the bigger picture, the requirement to get the land on which you want to mine zoned correctly should form part of the broader requirement of consultation and discussions and negotiations which take place in the course of mining companies' acquisitions of mining rights. Then, Honourable Chair, that's the gist of what I wanted to bring to the attention of the committee. Just a couple of quick points on sort of drafting and small issues. As I say, in principle, we think the bill is absolutely fine. We don't have an issue with it. We think it's good, and we think it's long overdue. There is a clause at 23 of the bill which talks about the participation of traditional councils in land use scheme. There's no detail, unfortunately, currently in the bill of what that participation is going to envisage. I don't claim to speak on behalf of all traditional communities, but certainly as far as the RBN is concerned, they would not be satisfied with merely assisting in determining how community-owned land is zoned. The RBN has, you know, the history of the RBN's acquisitions of its land is a long and torrid one, and the RBN's land is important to it, and it believes that it should have a right to determine how its land is zoned. And I would say that this accords with the general principle of spatial planning law over the years, which is that it is only the landowner which ultimately is capable of making the application to rezone the relevant pieces of land. So it's very important for the RBN to have control over how its land is used. Then lastly, it seems to me, and I may be wrong, it has definitely happened before, that the provision relating to appeals, where an appeal against a decision taken under the Act cannot be carried out if the upholding of the appeal will lead to a variation, accrued rights having been taken away. It just seemed to me that this is a somewhat toothless provision, because I can't imagine any situation where a decision taken under the Act to zone a particular piece of land or any other decision will not result in rights being accrued. So it effectively, as far as I can tell, the appeal committee will not really be able to make any finding at all in respect of any decision made. We also think that we need a good, strong dispute resolution mechanism which has teeth and which is quick and effective. We scoured the bill for evidence of what's going to happen in the case, which is definitely going to happen, and I've seen it happening now in my legal practice, where there's a dispute between a landowner and a land user regarding rezoning applications. It's not clear what powers the Municipal Planning Tribunal is envisaged to have to deal with that kind of dispute. And I think that's really all we have to say. There's a summary of the most important submissions at the end. Again, the RBN is very grateful for the opportunity to have made these representations, and will happily field any questions that the committee may have. van der Wand.
Van der Wand. Mr. van der Wand, thank you very much. Thank you very much. I'm told that the four NGOs, I don't know whether they're still NGOs, have arrived. And we gave them a slot earlier on, but they're here now. Thank you, Mr. Fanavad. Can you come forward, please? How many are you? Representing everybody. Come forward, please.
Can the mic pick me up from here? Here enough. We'd like to thank the committee for the opportunity to present. Just to be clear, I represent Isande Institute, which is an urban policy NGO. We've been joined in the broad strokes of our submission by a number of other NGOs that come from around the country: the Built Environment Support Group, Plan Act, AFSA's Core Plan, the Socioeconomic Rights Institute of South Africa, and the Development Action Group. So these are the essentially each NGO has submitted a separate submission, but we find that there's some overarching themes that cut across all of the different submissions, and so we'd like to just present what the common elements are, and then I'll speak briefly to one or two things that Isande Institute thinks it can contribute to the conversation that we speak with our voice and not with the kind of collective voice. So just in terms of the joint submission, we would like to note that we've struggled to find good spaces for public participation and engagement with this bill. The department has struggled to make to open real spaces for deliberation, and particularly considering the impact that land use management has on the lives of the poor, the ability for them to access urban space or rural space and claim their rights in that space. We have some concerns about people's ability to understand what's been happening during this process, and it's been a very lengthy process, but without much substantive engagement. And I think, particularly because some of its elements haven't been fully thrashed out and have largely been left to provincial legislation, and I'll return to this idea. I think that's a particularly important aspect, that we haven't seen much engagement in communities with what this bill would mean for their kind of future prospects in terms of claiming of rights. Then in terms of the four substantive issues that we would like to highlight, we think there still is a lack of clarity about the respective powers and functions of the different spheres of the state, particularly as relates to provinces and municipal functions. We have some concerns about how integrated the approach is to urban informality or informality more generally, spatial inequality and environmental sustainability. So there are definite references throughout the bill to these common elements, but we don't know if those add up to a coherent approach. And these are definitely some of the aspects that have bedeviled planning, spatial planning, and land use management in South Africa up until this point, and have really prevented especially municipal local government to act progressively to address spatial imbalances and to increase access of the urban poor and the rural poor to land in a kind of systematic way rather than in a haphazard way. Then we would also like to note the serious capacity constraints that exist not just within the state but within the planning sector as a whole, and that this bill raises the bar in terms of what we expect from not just the state-employed planners, but the planning profession in general. And we have some serious concerns that the progressive elements of this bill will be blunted by the profession's inability to cope with the kind of demands that the bill places on the profession. And then finally, some of the organizations that work in more rural areas would also like to raise a flag about the land use management tools that are highlighted in the bill, suggested in the bill, as they apply to communal areas. Then, as a group of organizations, we've been exploring something called the social value and function of land, which is something that has resonance in South Africa, primarily, but largely unrecognized in our kind of legal dispensation. But it has a very firm and quite prominent history in Latin America. And I'll return to what the social function means and what its potential would be to really strengthen the progressive elements of this bill later in the presentation. And then finally, given all of the constraints we think still remain in the bill, we would like to highlight the fact that this bill, even though the DFA was really an attempt to provide bridging legislation, this bill should also be understood to be incomplete, and that we really think there needs to be a structured way to review the implementation of the bill and to learn kind of very systematically about what its impact is in practice, and then have a further iteration that is a far more effective kind of a consolidation of practice. We feel like this and there's a lot of practice that still needs to unfold, and this bill will enable that. But yeah, we feel like it's important to emphasize that it's not the final product, and that there's at some future date that there should be a review. So I'm now speaking with the Sandler Institute's voice. So just to clarify two things we think need a little bit of attention, extra attention paid to them. The first is really the social function of land. And as the Colombian Supreme Court quote here indicates, it has a very long history in Latin America and is now recognized as a legal concept in the European courts as well. And really the attempt with the social function of land is to recognize that individual property rights are really only have to be subjected to a kind of common good restraint or consideration, but that we actually need to move beyond that, and we need to actually place the emphasis on both the state and on the property holder to use that land in a way that enhances the life of the community. So their private use needs to be in line with the greater good use. And so it contains within it the potential to combine kind of individual rights with collective rights, and is very much in sync with the kind of rights framework that our constitution uses. So just to give you a concrete example of how it's being used in Latin America, both in terms of in the Brazilian constitution, both in terms of rural land use and in urban land use, it places the onus on the land owner, and beyond that the state, that the land has to be used, it has to be productive, it has to be used for the greater good, and the attempt really is to curtail processes of speculation, of leaving land fallow for various reasons. And then in the Brazilian constitution, they actually spell out the actions the state can take if land owners don't aggressively use their land. And as you can see, it's a kind of a graded process where it moves from more minor attempts to encourage the use of land in particular ways from land users, and then progressively gets more and more intense until the land actually is in danger of being expropriated by the state if it isn't adequately used. So the notion of the social function of land really has the ability to pull together many, many elements that already can be found in the bill, which are very progressive, but will enable us to underpin them with a more coherent doctrine, and a doctrine that finds roots not just in South African traditions, but also in international law and constitutions elsewhere in the world. But it also enables us to underpin some key elements in the bill with a wider rationale. So I'll just pick two examples. The non-impediment function section in the bill, which I'm sure the committee will be hearing a lot about from various different angles. We think it's a very progressive element of the bill that the effect on land value can't be the sole determinant of a decision. But we feel like we could extend that to a positive injunction where the land use decision needs to promote the social value of that land, and equally so in the section on land for parks, open space, and other uses, where the suggestion is that residential development needs to be accompanied by the provision of land, kind of public land, essentially, for parks and open spaces. We think narrow set of uses of land that are for the public good, and we could expand that potentially using the social function as the test of whether it's being adequately used. And underpinning much of the social function discourse is an emphasis on communal decision making about land use, and so it would also necessitate, and the bill does allow for this, public kind of extensive public consultation about the sort of public space, new public space like this. So as I've said, we feel like the social function has a really valuable contribution to make in terms of underpinning many of the progressive elements, but we also think that it's important that there are many opportunities that have been foregone in this bill to link an idea like the social function to specific tools, land use tools, that can be used for progressive outcomes, value capture being one example, and the Development Action Group has done quite extensive work on what land use or what value capture might look like in South Africa and how it could be used progressively by the local state, particularly not just to raise revenue but also to have a systematic way to influence land investment decisions. And then finally, this is my last slide, there are numerous references to informal settlements throughout the bill, and the need to approach informal settlements as part of a wider process of spatial planning, and that appropriate tools need to be used to either upgrade or regularize these settlements. But a worrying part is really the fact that in Schedule 1, where it details what the provinces should be doing, what the provincial legislation should cover, that's really where you start to see a consideration of the particular tools that need to be thought through when it comes to informal settlement. So it details 10-year land use control and the provision of services. There needs to be a recognition that those three things, 10-year land use control and provision of services, will function in a different way when we're talking about informal settlement. And so there needs to be a conceptual differentiation made, but that needs to be considered as part of a wider land use management system. So you've got two parts to the system, but the interface between those two are vital. And just looking at our experience in general with the spatial development frameworks thus far, and particularly a review that the department itself did 2 years ago, we think that these elements, the description of the tools that need to be used to address informal settlements need to be far more systematically detailed in the bill, simply because the SDF experience shows us that unless there's clarity about how particular tools are meant to be used and what they enable the municipality to do or what they require the municipality to do, much of the transformational elements of these ideas that are introduced at a principles level and so on really don't have any impact on practice on the ground. And so part of the gap definitely can be plugged by building capacity within the state to understand what many of these ideas mean. But beyond that, we think you need to be a bit more systematic in the legislation itself about what the difference is between addressing the informal settlement and the tenure, the land use rights, etc., the control mechanisms that operate in that area, as opposed to the wider spatial, the land framework, the land governance framework. I think I'll leave that.
Thank you very much. do you pronounce your name as Gogens?
Gogens.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Gogens. This is an opportunity for us to go to the next presenter because we have two presenters before we entertain questions.
Chairperson, I'd like to ask a question to the presenters from COCTA KZN. In their presentation, they asked a lot of questions about the appropriateness and competence of the executive mayor or the executive hearing appeals and raised some concerns around the independence of that or the independence consideration of that. And then they also raised a whole host of concerns around establishment of tribunals, the cost thereof, broken hearings, etc., with the expressed objective of having the determination of tribunals being an optional appointment. I understand that. But what they didn't do is, in the absence of actually having a tribunal or not, say what is their proposal to address the capacity or lack of capacity to plan in the absence of the executive of a municipality considering appeals or in the absence of a tribunal to consider appeals. What is their solution to the situation that could arise where the local authority doesn't have the capacity and it's inappropriate for them to be the player and the judge and the referee and the absence of a tribunal because of lack of skills, especially in rural municipalities or plucked-land towns? They just don't have that planning capacity.
Any other question?
Thank you, Chairperson. My question to COCTA, again, on the issue, because they were just mentioning the issue of the quorum, that the tribunal will fail to meet due to quorum, but when looking at the bill, the section 36, it indicates that members of the tribunal should be 5 or more. So the quorum of 5, I don't know whether it will be difficult for members to meet, or maybe they are against the more, because more it means anything, it can be 20 or whatever. Maybe if they can clarify their concern on that one, because that's the minimum is 5 or more. Then the other one is on the issue of the appeals. It seems as if they're not, because when looking at the bill, the section 51, it talks about the internal appeals. It seems as if they're not satisfied. I don't know, because they didn't indicate their proposal, because the bid states clearly on the processes of the appeals, but I didn't hear them proposing that if they're not satisfied with what is contained in their bill, what is it that they are proposing. I think the other one has been asked on the practical questions of the mayor and whatever, because also when looking at the bill, it talks about co-opting, you know, appointing the experts, people with skills to assist wherever there's a lack of skills to ensure that this bill is effectively implemented. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll also like to ask the KZN Coctor Rep, also on the tribunal. There was a lot of talk about the impediment of the Constitution, and they proposed that tribunals must be voluntary. My question in this regard is, how will the monitoring be if people are volunteering, because there won't be anyone who will be holding them accountable? How are they going to foresee that the tribunals will account? And the other issue is on the capacity. Will there be enough capacity in that regard? Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. Just a small one before Sunday. I saw KZN COCTA put an analysis from their experience in the implementation of the DFA tribunal. They did a cost analysis of what it would cost. Now I want to know whether what are they comparing those figures with? I just saw one set of figures more about the DFA tribunal. I don't know if there's been any costing of what is suggested in the bill as a comparison.
What are they comparing the DFA tribunals against?
Chair, if you will indulge me, I do not intend to raise formal questions, but just issues which they may want to further address.
There's no question that's informal here.
We're having
a formal presentation.
No, not informal, but to say, thanks, Chair. Chair, I think maybe I should ask the first question. Chair, the first thing is to ask our colleagues to assist also with answering the question. Whether or not if they have read the court judgment to saying that certain powers belong to municipalities, whether we can locate or relocate that powers elsewhere. Because the questions have been are not very clear, because we in our own reading, municipalities must perform certain functions. And can we use capacity to divest municipalities of their constitutionally vested functions? Chair, without being defensive, also maybe a few things. Chair, we wish to also get clarity from our colleagues from KwaZulu-Natal. COCTA, whether it is indeed correct that an act of parliament cannot assign powers, or what do they understand by the word regulate? Two other things, Chair. Chair, I think we may be unwittingly getting ourselves to false conclusions from certainly problematic premises. When we talk about the cost of administering the municipal planning tribunals, and we're being presented with figures of about 5,200 members, the first fallacy with that kind of figure, Chair, is the fact that the bill itself expressly provides for the possibility of joint tribunals. Secondly, the bill does not say that if you sit in municipality A, you cannot sit in municipality B. The other thing that is also terribly well known in the industry is the fact that the volume of applications in many municipalities is not one which presupposes that municipal planning tribunals will sit on a daily basis. I think also it's important to say, Chair, that in terms of this bill, clause 35 of the bill specifically provides for municipality not to necessarily consider all its applications via municipal planning tribunals. Section 35(3) and 2 specifically invites municipalities to also delegate the powers to officials. So it is not that in all cases a municipal planning tribunal will indeed do that. So the question of whether 14,000 applications will go via municipalities and necessarily via municipal planning tribunals is a bit stretching what is not in the bill. Chair, the question around the section 33(3)(a) of the Constitution, I really want to invite our colleagues to say whether they truly do believe themselves to mean that you cannot have an internal appeal, and if within a structure you appeal appeal from one level to another level, one, does it exclude the court from listening to that application? And when, Section 33 of the Constitution, did they see what they are reading to say that you need to have an independent person to hear an appeal? Otherwise, in every case we deal with in the department, where a decision is taken by a review from one level to another, you are saying that you must go and look for somebody totally independent. Sure, maybe just the last one. There's this euphemism that we tend to say that once somebody is not in government, he's independent. And once you are out of government, you are certainly. When they were talking about these appeal tribunals and this concept of independence, I think it's something you may want to say for the clarity whether or not it means that for a body to be independent means it must be out of government. Otherwise, judges are, I guess because they are paid by the state, may then be accused of not being independent because they get money from public funds. So I just want clarity on what independent appeal tribunal that our colleagues are proposing, what it means in the context in which it has been said. I thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I just wanted to find out from the NGOs, or especially the Isanda Institute, who was a presenter on behalf of the NGOs, what their understanding is in terms of public participation and transparency. Because we conducted quite a number of consultations in provinces, and everybody was invited to come. The bill was published in the Gazette, and we invited everybody to come who had an interest in the legislation to come and make their presentations and to comment on the bill.
Thank you very much. Yes, Kosia.
Thank you, Chairperson. From the presentation by the Royal Bafokeng Nation, Ms. Farivak pointed out the challenge or the difficulty that they might face with regards to this bill looking into or making a consideration on the tribunal councils being represented in the what is called this plan. And I wanted just to ask Chairperson on how could the Royal Bafokeng see themselves since, or including the tribal councils, since we have a wall-to-wall municipality, and here we are only expecting to see the skilled people or the skilled personnel to administer the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think the one for public participation has been asked. I wanted just to check, because public participation is in different ways. It can be verbal, written, and however. Then I wanted to, the gentleman who was presenting, to just unpack that. Then the other one, I think he was emphasizing on the reviewers. Because when looking at the bill, it talks about, especially Section 15, Subsection 5 and 6, about that each and every 5 years there should be a reviewer, and also the public will be invited to submit some written representation or with what type of maybe the reviewer that he's talking about. Then on the Bafokeng, you were talking about the role of the traditional council. I think when looking at Section 23.2, where it talks about the involvement of the traditional council in the participation, development, preparation, adoption, amendment of the land use scheme, where that it doesn't cover your role here. And also you have mentioned that you've got a good relationship with the what is RL Rustenburg local municipality, whereby you are discussing developmental issues. Don't you think that you are playing also a role? Then the other one was on the exclusion of all the mining related activities, because when looking at the Schedule 2, it just identify all the land use purposes, of which mining is part, although it has not been unpegged, but it is part of all the land use purposes. Then the last one, also to Royal Bafokeng, was the picture. Because while I was looking at the picture, what came into my mind was the issue of the NEMA, because it is both, you know, this NEMA Act and other things, which has got the impact on what you have shown us there. Then the last one was the issue of the framework. You've mentioned of the framework for the provincial and local government, but I don't know, maybe you understand the bill differently, because it talks of the framework at all the spheres of government. Maybe if you can just clarify that so that we hear it, what is the concern. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I'm happy to do that. I'll try and be brief. Which other alternatives are there? I didn't suggest any because it's not our ball that we're looking at. But in our act, we do have an act in our province that do very similar things. We're probably playing approvals in terms of that act. We believe that there are other models that can be cost a lot less, can be as efficient, and give very, very similar results. Which is what we want. I think at the end of the day, we want to see good and responsible, sustainable planning. The system that we use in KwaZulu-Natal at this stage, which we've implemented in the last 2 years, is that every application must be assessed by a registered planner. A registered planner is somebody that is accredited by the Council for Planners to have certain qualifications and certain skills. They will take that application through its process. They will ask any missing information from the applicant, traffic engineering reports, that kind of thing if it is needed, which whole system around how to get that information, gather that information. They then prepare a report on the application, assessing that application. And that report goes to council. And most municipalities in KwaZulu-Natal have opted to devolve that function to their EXCO, to their executive committee. And so their executive committee gets the application plus a report from a registered planner employed by them assessing that application and making a recommendation to them. And so that's the system that we're using instead of a tribunal. It costs a lot less. It goes fairly quickly if the capacity is there. It was difficult for us in the last 2 years because a lot of its functions were performed by provinces, by us as province before, and it's very new to most municipalities. But we are seeing to see those things going through now. We are seeing planning rules coming out in 6 weeks, 8 weeks regularly now on the smaller applications, which really it's fine. It works. We are now actually revising our bill or our act, and that is something that people are actually very happy with. They say, yes, it's not perfect yet, but that's more because of implementation and the move of a function from province to government than anything else. They like that system, they really do. They don't want to go and appoint tribunals. And so that's our system. I'm not saying it's for anyone, I'm not sure there are other ones. Then, as far as the checks and balances are concerned and the monitoring,
knowing that we're going to discuss public participation at length in this debate, I want you to factor in public participation in your system that you prefer and see whether this registered planner will conduct this. Instead of dealing with the mayoral committee only, but how other people outside municipality will participate in the process you're suggesting.
Now, the process that we've got on public consultation part is the first phase is that information gathering phase of application. There's also a pre-application part that's now coming in. But once you've got a complete application, in other words, everything's there. The environmental assessment's there. The traffic engineer support's there. The geotech's there. If it's what's called a particularly sensitive site, that information is there. The layout's there. The proposed zonings and land use, everything's there. Once everything is there, then it does go through a public participation process. I mean, our particular province, we shall mechanism for that. It's we're trying to make it appropriate for the application. If it's merely a realization of a bowling line, then all you need to consult is the person next door that shares that boundary where you want to relax the bowling line. If it's something bigger than that, the change in land use, amendment to the scheme, residential goes commercial, that will normally entail notice in the newspaper, could be public meetings and hearings and a whole lot of other things as well. Normally you've got to let the people, your neighbours know at the very least. So we've got a whole system there, a progressive one, and depending on the nature of the application, your participation will be linked to that. Once that's done, the planner assesses the whole application, including these technical reports and inputs from the public, and then they make their recommendation to normally council. Council can delegate it to other people. Some have, the Queen have, and Mr. Tuzi did, Paracusa did. Not a problem with that. That option's also open to the councils. Then
one last point, I'm curious. I'm really am curious to understand what you're referring to. In the past, government used to have a tender board consisting of people who are outside government. And government stopped that process and created internal processes, which everybody agrees is corrupt currently. Now, this bill seeks to remove the initial phase of the processes of the application so that it recommends to the council after all these other things have been considered. And you suggest that those initial parts should be dealt with by 10 town planners and officials, not by mayors and councillors. It must be submitted to them later after the decision has been finalized. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes, what the council actually gets before them is a report from a registered planner that actually sets the application. It's got all the documents where it talks to all of that. It evaluates the whole application, so they get the whole assessment and the recommendation. And then we've got the checks and balances built into our law. One of the things is that that report is open to the public at no cost. Anybody can go and draw any of those balance reports and see what was in there. What did the planner conclude? What did the planner assess? We've got provincial norms and standards, which we're bringing out. We've got criteria. What must be addressed in an application? What must be evaluated against? So it's a whole system. It's not just one thing. I think 30 checks and balances in the system to make sure that it's an open and transparent process. So that you can't decide something. You've got to show in that balance report if traffic was an issue, how it is going to be addressed. If a council goes contrary to the recommendation of a planner, that's got the freedom to do that. But they must know that the public will know what's in that report because it is available to everybody. So is the application, so is the comments received by the public. All those things are guaranteed open and available to everybody. So everybody's got access to all the information. Nothing's hidden. And hopefully that will result in better decision making. I've already talked about the checks and balances that we're doing. I'm not going to go into more detail there, but I can if necessary. Then we also do monitor the applications, but we didn't draft special law for that. We do that under the Systems Act, and we've got enough powers under the Systems Act currently to call for the things that we need. There are here and there something that we need to just maybe do when we don't get information from the municipalities, but we do monitor those applications. Not to take people other things or anything like that, more to see what the trends are in development in the province, and if we feel that there's an area that people don't understand very well or need to pick up, like we've had now conditions of establishment, then we remedy that by getting guidelines on that and getting a team together to develop standard moral conditions that they can use in their developments, and we build the capacity of municipalities in that way. Then if I can continue briefly, Sandra asked a question, can it be relocated with power to do municipal planning? Yes, brief it can. We never said that it can't, but what we are saying is that we cannot force a municipality to say you have to give that power away to a tribunal or to an official of the municipality. It is yours to keep away, it's yours to keep. Like I I said, some municipalities have done that, especially on the smaller types of applications, and we've got absolutely no problem with that. We've got no problem with any municipality in KwaZulu-Natal wants to establish a tribunal for that purpose, not at all. We're just asking, can it be forced in that manner? Assigning the powers, and the difference between the regulator, I think the assignment, if you look at the Johannesburg versus Gauteng Tribunal, the tribunal case, fairly early on, I think around about in the first half pages, you will find that word in there, and the court talking about the assignment of powers to a tribunal. In that instance, it was appointed by the Premier of the province, but we believe the same principle will apply also at the municipal level. Then, I think also our presentation, we did touch on that, and maybe just we need to do it again. We have a problem with an internal appeal. But internal appeal and the effectiveness of an internal appeal should be judged against whether it will be impartial. If I want to take leave next week and my boss doesn't want to grant me the leave, I can go to his superiors. Superiors never see my leave application, state my case, and maybe I'll get my leave. Not a problem with a situation like that. But what we try to show in our presentation is that every development that will go and appeal in a municipality, that municipal council would have had some involvement already at that point in time with that application. It will not be a new application to them. They would have had some dealings with the applicant or the public or both by then, and we're saying that that can't be. But internal appeal doesn't work in a situation where the body that's hearing the appeal already had some dealings on that particular issue. And that's why I think we need to do a distinction there. All right, I think that's...
Can I help you again, Chief? I'm worried about two things you just said now, which seem to be contradicting each other. The first part is the assignment of functions.
Yeah.
It's the municipality's responsibility to conduct the consideration of applications. Now, if it gives that function to a certain group of officials, including whoever else they deem to do so, but call that a tribunal. And when the first phase of that comes to them, and if somebody says you did not apply your mind to what was presented in front of you because you said the report is public, so the municipality, the council decides otherwise, and perhaps they did not apply their mind, where do they appeal to in terms of your own arrangement? Do they go to court?
No. We do believe that there is a need for tribunals. Court system is very expensive, very lengthy, not really good for development. We believe that municipalities, you see, that is where we believe there is room for tribunals on the appeal side of things, not on the deciding application in the first instance, but on the appeal side. And so the model that we are now going for in KwaZulu-Natal, and we've just workshopped that 2 weeks ago with municipalities, and they really all support that wholeheartedly, and that is that municipalities will appoint, and some of them will do it jointly, appeal tribunals. I believe it's the same under the Gauteng, new Gauteng Act, even the Western Cape got something similar. And so they will then appoint people for that purpose. So what they're saying is that, in our case, they make the decision in the first instance. If there's any problems with that or any disputes, I think the previous speaker talked about this dispute, that will then go to these tribunals. And those tribunals will have planners, lawyers, environmentalists, land surveyors, engineers on them, which helps quite a lot because often the disputes are of a technical nature. We believe that this impact is such that we need the extra turning lane. The applicant says, no, we don't, it's unfair and unnecessary. You'll find your civil engineer on that appeal tribunal. They will be able to actually hear all these expert witnesses, the applicant's engineer, the objecting party's engineer, and then they will adjudicate that. So that's where we believe there is room for a tribunal. I haven't addressed the matter of a quorum. I don't know if we should maybe, Martin, if you just want to say a word around that.
Chair, thanks. Basically, what we were just dealing with there in terms of quorums is that particularly when it comes to adjourned hearings, that it's quite difficult later on to get the same members. Say, for instance, we speak about the five members as provided for. To get those same five members to sit down 2-3 weeks later is not that simple a task to do. The other thing that we've picked up over the years as well is that often said, well, you've got a tribunal member which is part, who is a professional, and that professional does not want to be used in their own town, that also creates a problem for us. So you, for instance, say, for instance, Lady Smith, you're a particular you're a professional, and there's a hearing in there that you have to get somebody from elsewhere. And those are the type of issues that we're speaking about. It's not that it can't be done. It takes time to do these things, and it delays issues. That's all we wanted to say to you. Thank you.
Can we move on?
For the Royal African.
Yes,
thanks, Honourable Chair. I won't deal with the questions in the order that they were given, because I just wanted to make one thing clear, and I must apologise. In some sense, the cart is a little bit before the horse, because our submission really, and the reason we're here, why the Bafokeng Nation wants to make these presentations, we are happy with this bill. We have, however, seen what the Chamber of Mines is going to tell the committee tomorrow. And it is in response to that submission. It is in response to that submission that we're here. So we absolutely accept, as the Honourable Member pointed out, that mining is currently envisaged in the bill as an activity like any other for which a land use scheme can zone a particular piece of land. And we're happy with that. That's as it should be. What the Chamber is going to do tomorrow is come and ask the Portfolio Committee to amend this legislation so that the bill will provide for a blanket exemption on mining companies who want to do prospecting or mining activities on any land from having to comply with zoning legislation. So in essence, what it seems to me is that the Chamber is going to come here and ask Parliament to overrule the Constitutional Court judgment in the McSand case, which clearly and correctly, we think, set out what the legal position is and should be. So I hope that deals with the Honourable Member's question in relation to the appearance of mining in Schedule 2. We absolutely accept that some land has to be zoned for mining, and in fact, you know, we cooperate with the Rustenburg local municipality to do exactly that. What we don't want is anybody to be able to do whatever they like as long as they've got a piece of paper issued by the DMR. That should not give them the right to come onto the land and mine. They have to comply with all legal requirements on them, which include, as the one honourable member pointed out quite correctly, the obligations under the Environmental Management Act. That issue was in fact raised and was to be decided, but eventually got dropped for technical reasons in the Constitutional Court decision. The issue was, well, if I've got an MPRDA right issued under the mining law, do I then also need to get an environmental authorization? And to me as a lawyer, the answers to these questions are quite simple. You have to comply with whatever law applies to you. So if the MPRDA applies to you, you comply with that. What you're doing while you're mining might also involve environmental authorizations being required, so you comply with that. Likewise, if the relevant piece of land is not correctly zoned, you comply with the zoning legislation by getting it properly zoned. I just wanted to then just touch on a couple of questions which related to what we envisage being the involvement of the Supreme Court or traditional councils with the Rustenburg local municipality or generally. As the Honourable Member has correctly pointed out, we do have a very good working relationship and with the Rustenburg local municipality, and it works exactly as it should do. What we don't see in the bill currently, however, is in respect of traditional communities in particular, a provision which allows a traditional community to decide, within reasonable limits obviously, how its land is going to be used. That seems to be at the moment left largely up to the executive authority of the relevant municipality. And we think, I mean, for example, as a mining lawyer, in the mining code, there's a provision which does exactly that in respect of mining rights. It says that before, if community owns land, before any right can be given to any third party over community land, the community must be offered the land, the mining right first. And it's a
it's a novel provision, but we think a similar provision might be appropriate in the context of this legislation, which just to provide an opportunity for communities who've fought long and hard for the land which they own to have a real say in how the land, their land is used. My concern with 23.2 as it currently is drafted is there's insufficient content to how traditional councils are going to engage with municipalities. In the case of the Rustenburg local municipality, as I've said, the Bafokeng have a good working relationship with that municipality. But it would be good in the context of this kind of framework act to set out possibly the principles and that will apply. And it would be our submission that one of those principles should be that serious consideration should be given to what the relevant community wants to happen on its land. And I hope I've answered all the questions. There was one question regarding the framework nature of that. I completely agree. It is a framework act which should cover absolutely all spatial planning law in South Africa, but it should act as a framework. When I said that it should act as a framework, what I meant was just to avoid the situation where this bill, if the chamber submissions are included, the Chamber of Mines submissions are included, where this bill will essentially remove from a municipality the ability to control how land is used by saying, if you have a mining right, you can just ride roughshod over all landowners, including traditional community landowners' rights, and start mining. Mining companies, obviously mining is an important part of the economy, etc., but mining companies are companies like all others. You have to comply with the law.
Follow up? Remember, you have a list of questions still to be dealt with. If you want to make a follow up on what has been said, go ahead.
Chair, once we generally, in broad terms, happy about the submissions made on behalf of the Royal Bafokeng Nation, we just wish to confirm that we will look at the bill again to see where participation needs to be strengthened and make proposals to yourself. Just the caution.
You know that you have no right to do that. Now that it's in the hands of Parliament.
Okay.
You can make a submission like everybody else, but you cannot look at the bill again.
Thanks.
It is in our hands.
Thanks for the guidance, Chair. Just to say that we must just be careful about not creating another sphere of government. If we say that a traditional community or any other landowner for that matter may determine certain things independent of a municipality. Hence, I understood the Honourable Member to be suggesting that. Why don't we then look at it from the fact that this mandate belongs to the municipal sphere? How do we strengthen that linkage so that a decision is not taken outside?
You're becoming finicky now, because Section 50 allows the Royal Bafokeng Nation to work with the Premier of the province to create a framework within which everybody can play and be happy. So we don't have to argue that overstay the welcome on that point. Already we know now that Rustenburg works nicely with the Royal Bafokeng Nation. So all this act says the framework for the province can include the roles of everybody. And unfortunately, the minister will require that the law that is made in that sphere is also taken into consideration participation of everybody. Participation in this bill cuts across from national, province, district, local. So there's absolutely no problem with that. Go ahead, Mr. Kugans.
Thank you, Chair. I think there are kind of two groups of questions that were directed at us. The one say it had to do with public participation of the actual putting together of the bill. The two responses I have to that are just that of the six organizations that we're presenting on behalf of, only one was aware of and went to a provincial workshop. So that's comment, as if they happened, we weren't made aware of them, and as people with footprints in communities, particularly poor communities, we think that's probably a bad sign that there wasn't a general awareness that this process was undergone, and that the substance of the submissions that were made when the bill was gazetted, the original draft was gazetted. And then I think we were given a month comment time or so. And as a sector, we struggled because we represent communities across the country. We struggled to formulate a communal response, a group response, within a month's time frame, to formulate not only organizational reflections but also pull that together. And finally, just to say, most of us work in the housing or governance sectors, and so this bill impacts directly on our work, but we're not specialists in land use management and so on. So it's also slightly out of our wheelhouse. So we've also had to, part of the process was also pulling together all the facts we could to formulate a good response. So I hope that just clarifies the comments, even if it doesn't satisfy them. And then just in terms of our comment about review, I think I'm aware in the bill that there's a 5-year period where the different special frameworks are expected to be reviewed. But our comment was just that the framework bill as it stands, the way in which the different elements fit together, perhaps will need review equally at some point in the future. And in our joint submission, we recommend the formation of a group of people, of kind of professionals outside of the state, who can be appointed by the minister to reflect on the state practice and provide recommendations, and we gave a 5-year time frame for that, but that I think is up to debate. I think it's just a recognition that it's a good idea to have a structured way to relook at many of the issues that we think that will emerge once this bill starts to structure practice across the country, and obviously the minister's promulgation of the norms and standards, which will happen, will have a huge impact on exactly the efficacy of many of the elements of the bill, and we would just encourage that there's a maximum amount of public participation in that process. Just talking to public participation.
Yeah, Mr. Goebbels, Section 39, the Municipal Planning Tribunal and the Minister, acting in terms of Section 52, may, in the performance of the duties, co-opt, appoint, or employ the services of the technical or other advisors.
Absolutely. So
is this not covering your concern?
No, we would just emphasize that the review is that it should happen. So we're recommending that it should happen, obviously not to yourself, but to the department, but also that we think that the whole bill should be under review, and not just things like the special frameworks or the operation of tribunals.
In the performance of the duties, they can ask for an advice.
Yes.
Which means that the minister would ask, can you advise me, because the performance does not meet my expectation.
Yeah.
Can you advise me? And I think this is what you're calling for.
Yeah. No, it's something we're supporting. Yeah. Yeah, we think it's an important part.
Oh, yes, the KZN co-opter, you presented a list of figures and costs, and the department is curious to find out what are you comparing that against in terms of this bill in particular.
Honourable Chair, I thought we had dealt with that already, because we had said that the system that we're using at the moment is where we're having councils that are dealing with this and planners within the municipalities that are dealing with it in terms of how we see it at the moment. But I don't know if there is further clarification that's required.
That's fine. Thank you. DG?
Thank you, Chair. I think at the end, if I had the colleagues right, they were proposing an appeals platform that would be comprised of private professionals. Now, if they use the benchmark of the 14,000 Gauteng applications and the 10,000 KZN applications vis-a-vis now creating a tribunal of private professionals, have they done the comparison? What would it cost?
DJ, I'm sure you're not asking him to do that now.
No.
Yes.
Chair, if you want me to respond, I'm just very briefly in respect of that. I think the numbers will be much less, Chair. The point that we tried to make earlier as well is that even in terms of the Planning and Development Act that we've got in running in 2 years, there's only 34 applications that have now accumulated over 2 years. So I think the numbers are much less. So I think that's the point we're making. You will not have that where we might have, as we mentioned earlier, might have 10,000 applications a year for the whole province. You're only going to have 30 or so applications that you need to go through that process. So the cost implications will be much less.
Thank you, Chief. Any question that has not been responded to? I have noted in my list of questions that all of them have been responded to. Everybody's happy. Thank you very much. Now we move on to Legal Resources Center. We've been hearing from planners and surveyors. Now we want to hear from the lawyers.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. My name is Janet Love. I'm speaking on behalf of the Legal Resources Center, and we have made a written submission to the committee, so I'm not going to take you through every word and sentence of that. But in making this presentation to you, by way of introduction, I wanted just to mention that in our presentation, in our submission to the committee, we do identify some specific clauses that we believe could be or should be amended, and we give recommendations as to how those amendments could give effect to the improvements that we're suggesting. So while I'm not going to mention those specific amendments, I merely wanted to highlight this for the attention of the committee in case it is of use. The second point was really just to say a little bit about why we place so much importance on this piece of legislation, and I wanted to mention this because I think it provides a context to the four key points that I wished to cover. First of all, I think that planning is a key vehicle to ensuring that cooperative governance as a principle can take effect. If we don't pursue a process of planning that recognizes the complexity of intergovernmental relations, we will never give real meaning to the notion of cooperative governance. So that's the first reason that we place the kind of emphasis that we do on this piece of legislation. The second thing is that we believe that any planning process will be doomed if priority is not given to those who are most immediately affected. And when I say most immediate, I mean that whatever takes place in the form of a development is in the nose, in the eyes, in the face of particular people. Those people have to have priority in the consultation process. And for us, that means that there are specific requirements for planning that can definitely contribute to ensuring that our population, which has a majority of people who are still currently disadvantaged as a consequence of history, as a consequence of where they are, unless we ensure that the planning prioritizes consultation and provides them with a basis for beneficiation, we open ourselves out to planning that will not be sustainable. So it's in that context that I wish to raise 4 points. The first one, and these are the 4 points that, as I say, are in our submission together with some specific detailed comments, but I think they're the four principal points. The first one deals with the issue of communal land and questions that relate to development and mining on communal land. The second issue is to look at mining as a specific form of development. The third issue is to look at the issue of local participation and municipal local government responsibilities. And the last issue is the issue of sustainability. So, talking about the first issue, we believe that our point of departure, so let me start there. Our point of departure is that we believe that community, as we know it today, comes in particularly in the communal land areas with a legacy that is very rich and very meaningful. We have, as the Legal Resources Center, pursued a number of cases in our courts to ensure that there is recognition by our legal system of what we have put as a society in our constitution, and that is a respect and a recognition of customary law. This is our point of departure. Having said that, we are saying that customary law needs to be, in this piece of legislation, clearly recognized as a source of law that is equal to statutory and common law. That doesn't mean it prevails, but it also doesn't mean that statutory law prevails. It means it must be looked at and considered on an equal footing. Having said that, we also believe that when we look at what customary law brings with it in terms of history, it brings with it, and we achieved a clear statement of this by our constitutional court in our representation of the Richtersveld community, that what it comes with is a recognition that community has had the right to exploit natural resources on its land, not just above the land, but also beneath the surface of the land. And that right of ownership in the land is something that is a part of indigenous law in our country. So it's from those points of departure that we are moving. What we are saying, however, is that just as the National Planning Commission has recognized, in practice, the National Planning Commission says, land rights in practice differ depending on how land is used. And that for us is an important statement which maybe we need to unpack. But it is clear to us that if land that is occupied by people who have practiced primarily agrarian practices, agricultural practices on land, if that land is going to be used for other activities, whether it be mining or anything else, the way in which that community relates to that land and the use of that land is clearly going to be different. And we need to make sure that our planning processes recognize that and ensure that the community itself is not just protected, is not only fully consulted, but is a community that genuinely stands to benefit. And for us, that's really important, that our rural communities really stand to benefit. If they do not, we will not sustain developments that we try to pursue. If a rural community that has steeped in poverty has no benefit from a mining operation that is happening alongside it, it will not be able to understand that the international market for that particular mineral has collapsed and therefore there may have to be cuts at the mine. The community will not understand that because they have not benefited when there were no problems of the international prices. That is just one example. Secondly, we are saying that when we're looking at the issue of the participation of traditional leaders in terms of the way in which communal land is used for any kind of development, particularly mining, if we look at this participation, it is vital that there is a clear requirement of general community participation under customary law. Without this, there is a problem that the notion of the participation by traditional leaders can be used to bolster what is unilateral, distorted chiefly power, which undermines the inherent accountability mechanisms that are part of our customary law system. We do not want that accountability to be undermined. The difficulty with delaying, which is currently the case, any integration of communal land into planning processes is that, firstly, we retain a division that, frankly speaking, will continue to undermine and further marginalize those who live in communal lands and who are already the most marginalized millions of our country. We're talking about 20 million people. It will further marginalize their situation. But secondly, we are also in a situation where, without having planning in those areas, without having an effective municipal governance and land use in those areas, there is absolutely no chance that those areas will be able to be brought into the mainstream of our economy. There is no chance that our current proposal around the national planning mechanisms will have a chance of succeeding in those areas. We cannot isolate, divide, and create a level of false division between what are pieces of land that are adjacent to communal lands and communal lands when we're talking about planning. The fact that with communal lands there are going to be certain processes and procedures which are fully participatory and are based on customary law for communal lands does not mean we have to have a division. It means that we have to ensure that that aspect of participation is properly catered for in the Act. And finally, we need to recognize what is happening in these areas. At the moment, there are people, and I'm sure there are not many, if any, in this particular room, but there are many people who live in urban areas who talk about rural areas as if they're some sort of meadows, you know, that people can sort of have lots of goats and lots of space to do everything. The reality, as we know in this room, is very different. So-called rural areas, communal lands, are really rural sprawl and unmanaged, unplanned rural sprawl. And if we continue along this path, that situation will worsen, and the possibility for people in those areas to be provided with basic services will be increasingly difficult. My second point, Chairperson, relates to mining as a specific form of development. Now, there is a need to give very special attention to mining for a lot of reasons. Mining plays a vital role in our economy, and in that sense, mining doesn't only provide direct jobs, it provides a whole lot of indirect impacts, positive, many of them, impacts on our economy. At the same time, we also need to recognize that mining is a complicated business. We saw what happened last week. If we do not have a situation where local communities, I stress again, have a possibility of direct benefit from the mining enterprise, we will run and continue to run into problems. Secondly, we need to ensure that when communities are consulted about mining, they are consulted on the basis of the principle that is enshrined in the African Charter, to which, as you know, South Africa is one of the key signatories, as well as played a huge role in ensuring that that document was finalized in an appropriate fashion. And that principle is the principle of free, prior, informed consent. We are saying that we have to build that principle in, especially when it comes to an issue that is of such great economic significance, where so many people who are marginalized in communities can have their rights, in fact, further eroded as opposed to having benefits from such a possibility of wealth. We are saying it's vital to ensure that there's free, prior, informed consent for those community members. And we are saying that that is what will make the mining operation sustainable. That's the first thing. Secondly, mining is a cross-boundary operation in many instances. Sometimes the very license to mine involves a piece of land that is cutting across more than one municipality. Not only that, the impacts of mining have got a direct impact on surrounding and sometimes quite distant municipalities. If you look at the way in which mining operations impact on water, that's not something that's just around the actual mine. It's something that has got an impact way, way further downstream, and sometimes even in terms of our obligations to our neighboring countries. So to look at mining as if you can look at it in isolation on the one hand from the local community, or to look at mining as if you can only look at it in terms of a local community, in both respects is wrong. We have to look at mining differently from many other developments. Thirdly, everybody is talking about a need in our planning for uncertainty and confusion and red tape to be reduced. Okay? This is something that is a constant concern that is raised time and time again. The mining industry itself is seeking to have a lot of uncertainty and confusion put to an end. We have to do this in a way that does not negate local authority. I'm talking now about local community power and influence in decision making, that does not cut across issues that are to do with municipal authority, and we also have to ensure that it is done in such a way that it doesn't cut across a whole lot of other concerns about environmental management and sustainability, and I'll come back to that later. Clause 49 of your bill leaves things to the minister's discretion in terms of a published set of criteria insofar as the mining industry is concerned, as well as other so-called national industries. The reality is that there are no criteria specified as to how those there are no parameters specified as to how those criteria will be developed. And secondly, there's nothing that clearly indicates what kind of system of representation and what kind of system of appeal will be there for those kinds of national industries. And that's a problem, because when things like that, that are involving so much in terms of the resource base of our country, are left to chance, are left to a lack of clarity, and are not subjected to a clearly articulated process, the possibilities for wrong decisions taken with the best intentions in the world, the possibility for graft, and the possibility for, frankly speaking, a lot of opportunistic short-term manipulations is very great indeed, and we need to avoid that. The next point around mining is around the question of taxation. The mining industry recognizes that if it is going to be considered as a development, which of course in my view and in the view of the LRC, mining must be considered as a development, that's exactly what it is, but if it is to be considered as a development in this context of this act, it will also then potentially be susceptible to local tax. And it has indicated that it doesn't receive many services from the municipality, and so what will be the basis of the local tax? Now, clearly, that is something that has to be articulated, and it's not clearly articulated in the bill. However, the only thing that I would say is it may well be that mining is not provided with local services, but at the same time, mining leaves municipalities when it goes and when it carries out its operation with huge burdens of responsibility to maintain to put in place issues that contain and maintain the environment against the waste that comes from the mining operation. So the question of municipal tax could indeed begin to address some of these problems. You will recall the whole issue about acid mine drainage, for which millions and millions of rands of taxpayers' money have had to be spent in recent times, and many more millions will continue to be spent in the Johannesburg Central Witwatersrand and Western Witwatersrand Basin. In addition to that, you'll recall the problems that had to be addressed by the local authorities in Carolina. These are just examples. There are many other causes of problems that municipalities have to address, and so this is something that should be looked at within the context of municipal tax. Lastly, Clause 50 of your bill does not clearly categorize mining as part of development. It needs to do that. If you leave that gap, if you have in the law that kind of uncertainty, those who think it's development will go on thinking it's development, and those who don't want to think it's development because this act is an inconvenience for them will find that gap and sail through it very, very quickly in a manner that just, again, compounds confusion. The third point that I wanted to raise is around the issue about municipal responsibilities and local participation. All of us have heard the concerns, legitimate as they are, from municipalities about unfunded mandates. Every time there's some program to get delivered, whether it's health, housing, schooling, whatever, somewhere the municipality features. And the municipalities, in trying to responsibly carry out all their duties, feel very often, legitimately, that they have a number of unfunded mandates. Now, the more things that are left out of the net of local planning dynamics, and by this I don't mean that a municipality should have no regard for the province, no regard for the national government, no regard for customary participation. I have already said all of those things are important. But equally, we have to be making sure that what affects the local plan of a community is something that a municipal government has a final ability to declare itself and to integrate it into all of its other plans. Otherwise, we will exacerbate and make a whole lot more unfunded mandates, create complete confusion, particularly in municipal areas which are outside the metropolitan areas. Small towns, medium towns in rural areas are the ones who suffer most from the unfunded mandate problem. So the idea of having conflicting responsibilities that erode local control and the contestation that arises with regard particularly to relationships between traditional authorities and municipalities is one which this piece of legislation cannot allow to continue. Again, that is going to affect people who are already disadvantaged. The second issue is concerning the question of land reform. We've looked, when we have understood land reform, it's got to have a relationship to local government planning, but it also has to have that relationship not only because logic and the way in which services and the core responsibilities of municipalities are delivered requires it, but also because we need to understand the whole notion of land reform and its relationship to local planning around the question of land use rather than only around the question of land ownership. Up until 2002, the government systematically acquired land to enable municipalities to play a role in things like food security, job creation, and the kick-starting of small-scale agricultural commercial farming activity. But think about it, that is 2002. We all know that in 2002, many of our municipal structures were just in their embryonic stages, faced many challenges of just organizing the way in which they were going to function. And the result is this process of acquiring land for the purposes effectively of use by poor people on a sort of subsidized or rental basis in the form of commonage, that whole program where there was a lot of acquisition of land to enable the local authorities in particularly the poorer rural areas to enable those municipalities to play this role, many of those programs collapsed. What happened as a consequence partly of that was that the idea of local authorities playing a vital role in terms of food security, playing a vital role in terms of job creation in a manner that uses the land was actually something that was put aside. And instead we started to look at land reform much more in terms of ownership. We had all sorts of programs, the SLAG program, the LRAD program, the PLAS program, all these agricultural programs, all geared towards ownership. Ownership is not unimportant, but it can't be looked at alone. Just like when you look at housing, for a long time people were thinking about housing as if there was nothing called rental and as if there was no thing called government rental stock. Today we know that there is a very important role that government rental stock must play in terms of enabling people to choose to be able to move out of very desperate circumstances in a manner that transitions them into some kind of other arrangement, whether it be rental or ownership. Similarly, land needs to be used. And we are saying the commonage program, and by commonage, we mean the use of municipally owned land on a subsidized or rental type of basis for the poorest people to help them to have a place to graze for their animals, to help them to have a place to grow medicinal herbs, to help them to have a place to ensure that they have small food gardens. Those are things that we need to go and ensure become part and parcel as much as possible of many of the municipal areas. That doesn't mean it's a solution that solves everything. It doesn't mean it must be rolled out in a manner that doesn't take into account differences in circumstances, but it does mean that it's something that we must revisit, because in this time where food prices are set to rocket, food security is an increasingly important issue. My last point, Chairperson, is around the question of sustainability. Our Constitution does require that we look at the question of environmental rights in terms of keeping intact for future generations some of the basic resources of our country, keeping alive for them the notion of capital that they can use for future generations. And in this, we are saying that the question of sustainability needs to be rigorously looked at as part of each and every planning decision. Part of that sustainability is, for example, recognized in the National Planning Commission's document, wherein it talks about water security as being absolutely fundamental. But we need to spell out in the legislation clear principles that are articulated with regard to planning, implementation, and decision-making. Finally, Chairperson, we think that there is a way in which this issue of free prior informed consent and the principle of sustainability can be catered for by inserting in the legislation approximately 2 or 3 clauses. We have drafted a proposal for what these clauses could look like, but it's just to give the committee the wherewithal to really look at this question and to be able to chew on something concrete. At any point, we're happy to do further work on that if it will assist the committee. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, LRC. You are fortunately the last presenter in this part of the morning. We are already in the afternoon. We then open your presentation to question. All others were interrogated. Yours is no exception. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I would just like to ask Ms. Love, I like your surname, whether Section 7 of the bill doesn't cover much of your comments, because it talks to development principles. It talks, the very first principle there is about the principle of social justice, which aims at incorporating all areas and persons that were historically disadvantaged and excluded from planning practices. And then the other one, touching on what you've just been talking about, the second principle that relates to special sustainability, protecting the land in terms of prime land, like environmentally sensitive land, and other issues. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, I'll leave certainly the first question for to my colleague Henk Smith to.
Sorry, Chair. I'd just like a little bit more clarity on the issue that you raised about there being no adequate or defined parameters or for criteria regarding development of representation and appeal mechanisms for the Minister.
Thank you very much, Chair. the Section 7 and whether the general provision for development principles that can be elaborated further in norms and standards through a public consultation process, whether that is enough. We've heard this morning from two parties, Agri-SA and Royal Bafokeng Nation, that it is not enough when it comes to, for example, mining. And we agree in that regard. We're also involved in litigation against those very two parties, very two institutions, but on this point we agree that we must be specific on the issue of mining being regulated by land use and land prioritization, land use prioritization principles. So we agree with the Royal Bafokeng Nation that mining companies must comply with the law, including land use management law. And at the moment, the principles does not give us enough in that regard. More specifically so, when it comes to the treatment of poor people, modern people, and the unrecognized rights of people on communal land. Clara is going to take a while. Communal Land Rights Act or promotion of tenure protection under Section 25.6 is going to take a while. In the meantime, is EPILRA good enough? Interim Protection of Land Rights Act. Is it good enough and its procedures good enough? At the very least, this legislation should support both the protection and the right of people on communal land to participate in the decision about their development. So we're saying that it does require more specific. And we've been so bold to try and propose specific wording in this regard. In fact, last week's development plan confirms this again. It says the current framework governing land use in traditional areas is not working. In particular, it discriminates against women. And it says that is the third big challenge for rural development. Now, Section 7 does not help me to address the third biggest concern for our 2030 vision. Thank you, Chair. Okay, spatial system. Chair, spatial sustainability and what it means. Our wording addresses ecological, social, economic sustainability. Spatial sustainability and how it's going to be unpacked in terms of the principle of spatial sustainability, how it's going to be unpacked in the norms and standards process is very uncertain. So we're similarly calling for very specific direction from the legislature with regard to that principle. Chair, and finally on internal appeals, we've heard graphically from KZN.
Excuse me, can I just ask, because I'm also relying on Section 7. Section 7D talks about the spatial resilience, the flexibility of spatial plans, policies and land use management systems and accommodation of and to ensure sustainable livelihoods in communities. Does it not cover what your concern is? I know what you said about the regulations, but I'm talking about this clause. Will it not cover that?
No, we've got to be very specific about promoting, taking extraordinary promotional measures for those with insecure tenure on communal land. And this is a law of general application that can give both the protection and the promotion. The standard of FPIC must be legislated specifically in terms. It's authorized by the Constitution. Even the RBN, the Royal Bafokeng Nation, says so today. But we need to say it in this legislation. Sorry, Section 7 is not enough.
I think that the point really for us is that We are not. If we were in a society, I don't know where such a society really exists. But if we were in a society of complete equality, the idea that one isn't having to protect those who have least, who are most marginalized and vulnerable, and promote their rights, one could understand. But when you have the kind of growing inequality that we have, unfortunately, at the moment, you have to do 3 extra measures, if not 23 extra measures, to protect and promote. Just to say around the question of appeals, there is a section on internal appeals, and there are some issues there, but the point that I was referring to refers to the section that follows that, section 52, which is the development application affecting the national interest. If you look at that issue, that section, I beg your pardon, you will see that the issues that are addressed there would include, for example, mining. The processes by which the minister is going to consider these applications and consider maybe representation that would be to appeal any decision that he or she had made are not in this section at all articulated. And when we consider what we mean when we look at a development affecting national interest, those are developments that in particular relate to things of massive economic significance, such as mining.
In Sunday, that it is not out of disrespect that we call you Sunday.
No, absolutely.
You gave us permission because your surname is tough.
Absolutely. Thanks. Chair, just before the committee takes a decision whether or not this bill itself adequately takes care of some of the issues being raised, because quite a number of those issues are indeed legitimate issues, we just want to say that, one, it's a framework legislation. Whilst the White Paper of 2001 had suggested that we would have only one single national law on this point and not provincial law, well, we just want to caution that it's deliberate also that we have not covered all the issues. But also a matter of small detail, Chair. The bill suggests an approach where the minister or at the provincial level, the premier, or at the municipal sphere, the question of the municipality itself, using other instruments to achieve some of the broad policy goals. Hence, when you look at the chapter on development principles, it is not something which will have the full details of all its intent. So I would take, for instance, the guidelines for developing municipal SDFs, Chair, that will, after this legislation, be actually be a guideline in terms of the law, but which we're already using for development of municipal special development frameworks. In that big document, the guidelines for formulation of municipal SDFs, you will see the things that municipalities must consider in developing their SDFs. There are special planning categories in that document, and they necessarily cater for the questions of mining, they cater for the question of transport, the question of linkages. They are necessary. In fact, there's a whole matrix of issues that must be taken into consideration when you plan at the municipal level. Chair, the question that you must assist us with ultimately relates to how much of this detail can we have in the national legislation? I think.
Chair, I think that it's understood that there should be, that when we talk about framework legislation, we are not talking about a piece of legislation that will prescribe each and every application procedure and each and every detail that any individual person or organization needs to pursue. It is an instrument that needs to cover all, I underline that word, of the essential principles. We cannot continue to have planning frameworks that are like a hide-and-seek game where you need to be a detective to pull it all together. The whole point about having a single instrument is that it pulls together all of those essential elements of planning. So it does not give comfort that if we find this or that document somewhere in somebody's cupboard, or if we look at this or that piece of legislation or piece of policy that existed somewhere else, that we'll manage to piece it all together. You can't, for that is going to repeat the very problems that we have. If all of those documents that you are referring to were working, we wouldn't be uninformed about them now, firstly, and they would have worked to make sure that there was the kind of integration that you are talking about.
I must admit that I quite like the SDF guidelines that you're referring to. They are excellent pieces of descriptive, lot of emphasis of local participation. In fact, the National Development Plan, where in Chapter 10 it now talks about ward-based participation at ward level for both planning and implementation, should have had a read of the guidelines, because the guidelines are quite strong in it. I don't see that reflected in the legislation, though, because the legislation says public participation in terms of regulations, and the minister will draw up regulations after public consultation. I think that the clause should also say that he should come to you, to the portfolio committee, before he finalizes the regs on public participation. It is very necessary. But the SDF guidelines are silent on a conflict mechanism when mining and other land uses are in competition. The SDF guidelines don't help us there. So please, that is not good enough, Chair. We need specific direction from planning law on mining and communal land.
Lawyers to come back tomorrow when the Chamber of Mines makes the presentation, because from this other lawyer we hear the same concerns. Ladies and gentlemen, honorable members, we have come to an end of today's session. We are meeting again at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning here on the same venue. Thank you very much for your concerns, your presentations, and your explanations. We really appreciate it. It's helpful for us to understand what's behind the bill, what's behind the concerns of various institutions, and how we should be sensitive to them. Thank you very much.